This evening, we are on Mark 1, verse 21 to 28. I kind of did a quick look ahead. Almost all of our texts will be coming out of either Mark or John. Most of them actually out of Mark, a few out of John as well. This evening, verses 21 to 28 of chapter 1. We'll begin by just reading the text. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority, and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. I realize in reading this that I put my emphasis in the smaller portion of the text. We will be spending most of our time discussing his teaching. I think there's a little bit more tangible question there to maybe address. And then his dealing with the demoniac. A little bit further out of our realm of experience, wouldn't you say? So we'll focus in on what is more common among our experience, even though it's lesser in the text. I think it's something we all relate to a little bit more easily. The text is primarily about two things: Jesus' authoritative teaching and Jesus' authoritative commanding. So we could say this, tying into what we did last week, "Behold the Lamb." If we behold the Lamb, or as Mark has it in Mark 1:1, if we behold Jesus Christ, the Son of God, same thing the demon cries out, we will find his authority to be overwhelming. It is an overwhelming sort of authority. The text isn't about the crowd's amazement, although that is certainly there to build up the authority, to concentrate on Jesus having healed a man, or the man himself who was healed, is to miss the point that Mark is trying to make. Two times the text tells us the crowd was amazed. One was in relation to his teaching. One was in relation to the exorcism. And why shouldn't the crowds have been amazed by those two things? The Gospels are filled with those two things all over the place. Jesus goes around teaching, and he goes around healing people, exorcising, all sorts of different things related to that. And it makes sense, right? For us, truth is imparted through spoken word. So teaching becomes absolutely central. But we also live within a reality. We have experiences. And so Jesus is able to exercise authority or power in the realm of our experiences such that we are changed completely different. So he has demonstrations of spiritual power and teaching that both intersect our experience of him and of one another. And it's natural that those two things should go together. Flip over with me, if you would, to 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul ties these two things together pretty tightly. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 1 to 5. "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." So Paul is saying here, I came to you with words, though not words that were overly impressive. I came to you with shabby words, in a sense, words that are not beautiful in oration or rhetoric. I came to you in plain words, so plain, unregenerate minds and hearts can even be impacted by them, as he comes with demonstrations of the Spirit. So what he set before them, verse 2, not lofty speech or wisdom, but Christ and him crucified. Similar to what we said last week, behold the Lamb. That's what I set before you. Behold the Lamb, the one who takes away the sins of the world. But in order to do that, words are indeed central. So verse 1, I'm not with lofty speech or human wisdom, we could insert there. But he did come with true words. We'll come down to that a little bit later on in verse 6 and following. Words are central, though. Verses 3, 4, and 5, something else kind of comes out. Though he did not come with impressive words, there was still action taking place. The plain, ordinary words of behold the Lamb needed nothing impressive to support them. The words themselves carried the power that resulted in changed lives. Right? Demonstrations of the Spirit and of power. I think there are two reasons. Insignificant people are the best people for carrying the message of reconciliation, as Paul has it elsewhere in Corinthians. Right? Two things. One, the mystery, proclaiming to you the testimony. If you have a little footnote there, if you jump down, it might actually say mystery. Mystery is the way to go in this one. That's the Greek word, it's mystery. Now, though we are testifying to something, it is still mystery. The mystery that is revealed is so simple, the simple can hear it. That becomes significant. Mystery is so simple, the simple can receive it. These people have nothing to rely on except what they know of Christ. The second thing that I think comes out, the weakness of the vessel shows the power of the message. Verse 3. I came to you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. And yet, the lives of the people of Corinth were changed. But that's kind of Paul's point, isn't it? Who is convinced by something that seems kind of out there by somebody who cannot use impressive words, right? Salesmen. Are they good at using impressive words? Of course they are, right? They talk fast. Their goal is to schmooze you, kind of get you to buy into something, even if it's not the greatest thing. That's what salesmen are trained to do. If it's a good thing, all the better. But the goal is to sell someone with words. And Paul's point is, I couldn't sell you with words, or I didn't sell you with words. I gave you words that were ordinary and plain, and yet you believed them. Yet there was a change of life. That only happens by the power of the gospel, the power of Christ, to bring change among them. And so when he says demonstration of spirit and power, I think they're the same thing. I think he's simply saying, you were convinced of something that no one should have been convinced by. Why? Was it because I was impressive in speech? No. It's because I came to you with words that were life-changing and life-altering. And you grabbed hold of them, and everything switched. They aren't impressive words, but they're true words. And those true words, and the result of them, changed your lives in demonstrations of the Spirit and power. The Spirit was present among you to make those words effective. That is what we find when Jesus teaches. So back to Mark 1. Lives are impacted. Jesus is teaching. The Spirit is active. And so what we'll do here now is, having connected words to demonstrations of power, both things that show up in this text, we'll move on just a little bit here to concentrate a little bit on the thing that amazes the crowds first, the authoritative teaching. So Jesus' authoritative teaching. Christ's authority is what amazes the crowds. And I think that's significant. It's not his teaching that is authoritative, nor is it necessarily the way he teaches that is authoritative, but the authority is a quality of the person speaking. It's not primarily in the content, it's not primarily in the method, and it's located in the person. And I think this prevents us from making two mistakes, then we'll deal with the way we are supposed to handle it. So mistake number one, if the authority is not primarily in regard to the teaching, but inherent in the person, it prevents us from an undue obsession with content. And I want to be careful here. Content is a wonderful and necessary thing. Content is a tool for us to get to the person of Christ. Apart from content, there is no relationship. If I don't know anything about my wife, I can't have a relationship with her. Content is important, and I need to have good content. If I'm misled or I put the wrong date for Jen's birthday, problems can ensue, right? I need to have good information. Good content is essential for my relationship with anyone, and particularly with Christ. What I mean is this. Content, as good as it can be, is still only a tool to get me connected to a person. So, for example, if I have perfect doctrine, if I have perfect apologetics, if I have perfect content across the board, yet I ignore the person to whom it all points, I've failed somewhere. My content has failed to take me all the way to my destination. Content is impotent in a sense. Right, we saw that from the law, Old Testament, unable to change lives. What is it that changes lives? Well, it's the Spirit's power. He does it through words, he does it through content, but the content is still merely a tool. So if we are to focus, I think, well on what it meant for Jesus to teach as one who had authority, it is to remove an undue emphasis on content and place it more on where it belongs, the person of Christ and how I relate to him. Another way we could say it is better to concentrate on the way we react to the content than the content itself, because that's how we react to the person. Now, moving on from that, methods. We don't want to confuse methods here either. A poor preacher who can plainly speak of Christ is better than a wonderful preacher who concentrates so much on method that he completely misses Christ. That's one of Paul's points in 1 Corinthians. Look for the guy who can plainly and simply set Christ before you. He's the one who changes lives, the one who can dazzle you with their verbal ability. Don't be awed by them if they can't set Christ before you. Also, related to that is confidence. Jesus certainly taught with confidence, but we are not to confuse authority with confidence, and here's why. I can stand before anybody and I can speak pretty confidently almost any subject matter that I want to, but it doesn't mean I'm right. I can be off. I can also tell you confidently, this is what this person says about this, this is what this person says about this, and I know it's so. Confidence is not the same as authority. Authority can give confidence, but authority and confidence are not the same thing. What authority centers on, I think, is two things: right of finality, and we'll draw that out, and power of forced stimulation, and we'll draw that one out as well, and in that order. So we'll do it this way. Authority often seems to be in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, that's how millennials are growing up. Authority is in the eye of the beholder. I don't need to pay attention to you because I reject the authority that you think you have over me. If you've ever had children, you know what that's like. What authority do you have? Christ didn't seem to have that problem. William Lane wrote a commentary over Mark, and I'm just going to read you a short paragraph that he had because I think it's so helpful here. The authority in view is not merely the power to decide, which is speak confidently, which is also the right to finality, which we'll draw out in a second, but to compel decision. In contrast with rabbinic exposition, with its references to tradition of the elders, here was prophecy. The authority with which Jesus spoke presupposes a commission and an authorization from God inseparable from the proclamation of the kingdom drawn near. In the presence of Jesus, men are disturbed. And this disturbance is the precise act of fishing to which Jesus called the fishermen. What he's saying is this. Jesus has a right to decide issues finally. You have heard it said, but I say to you, that is right of finality. That is, who gives you the right to make that decision as the end all? Jesus' authority was questioned, right? Repeatedly. For example, Matthew 21:23. When he came to the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching, and they said, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority? Right? That is asking, where does your right for this authority come from? Notice that they're not questioning his authority. It's set plainly before them. They can see it. When you're casting out demons, you know that this guy has authority. His teaching, though it may seem a little bit more subjective, isn't. He teaches the same way he casts out demons. Powerfully. Authoritatively. He has the right to do it this way. But he also has a power that he exerts as he does it. And that's the problem, right? If my parents simply tried to tell me to do something and never had the power to reinforce it, I have the right to reject their authority. However, when they exert their power over me, their authority is completely unquestioned. A little bit further down in Matthew 21, after Jesus gives a couple parables in relation to the Pharisees, they felt the authority of teaching too. Verses 45 and 46 of Matthew 21. And after the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they knew that he was speaking about them. But seeking to seize him, they feared the people because they were holding him to be a prophet. Jesus' authority in teaching exerts a power over those who hear him. The power is often rejected, which is what makes it different from commanding. Teaching is different from commanding that way. But he exerts this power to where we have to say to ourselves, what do I do with this? Really, what do I do with this? Do I take it full-fledged, swallow it down, hook, line, and sinker? Or do I try and push my power back and say, nah, that really doesn't. That doesn't have it for me. What these people ran into here is he teaches as though he has the right of finality and in such a way as they could feel and sense his power being exerted over them so that they knew that what he was saying was true. They knew what he was saying was inarguable. And this is where content meets experience. Right of finality, this right to decide the issue once and for all, that's largely a cognitive thing. But when you feel the power, when you sense it coming at you, that's tied to what I know cognitively, but it's also something that I experience. I sense it. I sense the weight, the gravity, the glory of what he's doing. So this quality of Jesus, though he possesses it, it isn't sourced inside of himself. He is not the source for his own authority. It comes from a learned experience of the Father. John 15:15. I'd encourage you to turn there and keep a finger in it because we're going to be using this as a go-to text a couple times here. John 15:15. Jesus says to his disciples, No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Two things worth drawing out there. One, Jesus is our master and our friends. He is by right our master, and by his grace our friend. But he is intimately connected as an equal with the Father. Let's just behold the Lamb for a moment. Christ is loved by the Father because during his life, he did what the Father said was of ultimate importance to him. If we were to think back to Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and following, the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall have no other God before me. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You shall speak of these things when you sit and when you rise, when you lie down. You shall tie them as frontlets between your eyes, put them on your doorposts," all of these things. "These words I command you today shall constantly be on your lips." Christ did that perfectly. Leviticus 10 and 11, the charge to the priesthood, Levitical priesthood. One of their commands, "You shall distinguish between the common and the uncommon, and you shall teach the people of Israel all of my commandments, all of my rules, all of my statutes." Christ did that perfectly. He left no stone unturned. Everything in the New Testament has its source in the Old Testament. That's why it's the New Testament. Sourced right on over. Pulled everything out, put it back in there. All Israel was supposed to be, and all Israel was supposed to do, Christ did to perfection. And so he was loved by the Father. But he didn't teach merely out of duty. He also taught out of compassion. One of my favorite passages here, Mark 6, 34. "When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd." And then what did he do? He taught them. And he taught the crowds. Christ's personality was so overwhelmed by his experience of the Father that everything he did was driven by the Father. Everything Christ heard, elsewhere in John, everything Christ saw of the Father, he relayed to his disciples. And nothing he gave them wasn't born out of that. Christ's personality so overwhelmed that his personality and the truths that he bore become inseparably intertwined. Christ is the gospel for that reason. And this is why teachers are so important, those who teach something. Because teaching is not merely imparting information, it is also imparting experience. Go back to 1 Corinthians 6, verses 6 to 13. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I want to show you the context that Paul draws up, this connection between words and demonstrations of the Spirit and power, where lives are changed by the power of the Spirit brought through words. And then he concentrates a little bit on the importance of teachers, living people, relaying the same sort of thing over and over again. So, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 6 and following, "Yet among the mature we do impart wisdom, although it is not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away, but we impart a secret and hidden wisdom," that goes back to the mystery of verse 1, "which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. But these things God has revealed to us through his Spirit." Jump down to verse 12. "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual." That relates to the command of chain, or the chain, back in John 15:15. What did Jesus say? As I heard from my Father, so I have given to you. So there's a chain there. Father, Jesus, disciples. Paul follows himself in that same train as being one of those disciples. So it came from the Father, through Christ, to the disciples, spread to all the world. Which means Christians have an inherited authority placed on them from the Father. We follow Christ, who gives the right of final decision. He has the right of final decision. He makes the final decision. But there's also this power that comes through the spoken word that is inherent in the message that Christians give. So Christians, by right, by virtue of following the Lamb wherever he goes, by virtue of speaking the words that the Lamb has spoken, has an authority passed along to them. But again, because this wisdom, because this content is tied to an experience that is foreign to us, it must come through other teachers. It must be taught by other people. Now, we obviously don't have time to do it, but two quick examples. One related to Pastor Andy's message this morning. If John Bunyan were to come up to you and say, you realize the implications of what it means to live by having seen the invisible, right? We live as though we see the invisible. Do you know what the implications of that are for your family at times? And we said, yeah, well, whatever, right? We can mentally assent to it and say, yeah, I know what that means. But when it comes down to it, is it more powerful? Is it more significant to see John Bunyan live out the implications of that than it is simply to hear him recite them back? Is a lived experience, a lived example, a weightier thing than merely the words spoken when it comes to absorbing them and being a receptacle for those words to hit you? Living with the experience of other Christians fits us for being better receptacles and retainers for the content that God gives us. The experience shapes us, it forms us, it molds us, which is another reason I spent last summer going over things like the sacraments and rituals of the Christian faith. Those experiences are designed to mold us and fashion us in ways that we couldn't otherwise. To use another example, and this one goes in the opposite direction. It goes to our inability, is maybe a way to say it. We don't have time to do it, but if we were to go to Genesis 11, look again at the Tower of Babel, we would learn two things that I'll just quick draw out from there. One, humanity is incapable of reaching things that are outside or too far beyond themselves. And the Tower of Babel story is kind of a satire. In a lot of ways, the silliness of humanity trying to ascend the heights to make a name for themselves, to make gods out of themselves, is just absolutely ridiculous. And in the story, you know, we'll build a tower up to the heavens. Well, God comes down to earth to look. And like, yeah, you're not going to make it up here, so I might just as well do this quickly and get it over with. I come down because you can't come up. And judgment is dispersed as people are scattered. On the other hand, it also shows the incredible achievements that humanity is capable of. Because what does God say? If we don't do this, who knows what they are going to be capable of, basically, right? They are incapable of such incredible things. If we don't confuse their language, trouble is going to ensue. So in order to temper and calm what would otherwise be an incredible wrath again, when the flood, flood is a result of man's sinfulness. What man would carry out if he were able to do it with one tongue would just be overwhelming again. And so God in grace sends judgment. What it shows is that we have an incredible ability to achieve great insights. Just think of the hard sciences, right? Biology, psychology, sociology, all of those different things, all the ways we can study humanity, all the way we can study the world. We have incredible ability for learning about our surroundings, for learning the world in which we live. It's just absolutely astounding. No one can master all of the sciences. It's just impossible. There's too much to know and too much to learn. But what we can't learn is what's beyond that. And the Creator is beyond that. We can only learn what we see around us, which is one of the problems humanity is in such a pitfall, right? We can't learn patience. We can't learn grace. We can't learn truth. We can't learn humility. We can't learn any of those things unless those attributes find a way to come down to us, manifest themselves to us, and we're able to take them on. That's why Christ's humiliation is the central tenet of the Christian faith. If Christ doesn't come down, model those things, we have no model for it. We have nothing. Our knowledge of God and our experience of God has to impact us from the outside to the inside. And that is exactly what Christ offers to do. And the irony is, so often, we think what we don't have, we don't need. This happens in a couple funny ways. I was told years back by someone who had never farmed, never really interacted with a farmer, we don't need farmers. Well, you are in the position of authority to say that, aren't you? Right? He thought, I don't know any farmers. Farmers don't give me anything. Therefore, I have no need for farmers. What I am ignorant of, I don't need. And that is our default. In most things, if I don't know it, I don't need it. Well, the reality is, that's bad. That isn't at all true. It's the opposite. So when it comes to the Christian faith, we can say things like, theology and doctrine, who needs it? Languages, who needs it? But the problem is, the people who experience those things know the depth of intimacy that they can draw you into Christ. And so you tell other people, you need these things. They're helpful. They're beneficial in ways you can't achieve otherwise. You say, who needs it? Don't let what you don't know be your undoing. That's the call throughout Proverbs. Get wisdom. It's better than anything you can compare. Get wisdom, get insight, do not forget, and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. Proverbs 4, 5, 7, verse 7. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. And whatever you get insight. Nothing is better than what we can receive at Christ's feet. Therefore, it is a call for our humility. We have lots more we could say there, but we're going to move on to authoritative commanding because we're running short on time. Second section of this, and I'm going to cut down to the chase here. I want to reset the stage because, again, we're a lot less familiar with this one. We'll just walk out through the text here. Verse 23, and immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, whether he infiltrated or whether he was sitting there the whole time. Text doesn't care to say. All we should notice is this. A demon-possessed man was there, and nobody thought twice, except he became noticeable. And he cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? That is a Hebrewism. If you were to look at the Hebrew language and be able to read that in the original, you would see the exact same wording there as is in the Greek. What to us and to you? What to me and to you? In fact, it's even often used in situations of confrontation, where the one who says, what to me and to you? It's almost like a statement of arrogance, kind of like puffing up your chest. What business do you have doing with me? That's kind of the feel. And William Lane, the commentator I referenced earlier, he makes a very good case here. Have you come to destroy us? Perhaps ought not be a question mark, but perhaps a statement. You have come to destroy us, but I know who you are. I got your number. You're Jesus. You're the Son of God. So the way William Lane would explain it and the way that makes sense to me is this. The Spirit comes up and he provokes. This is an experience of confrontation, a way of saying, do unto him before he can do unto you. So the unclean spirit comes and he says, what to me and to you? Kind of this arrogant puff up. You've come to destroy us, but I know who you are. And the idea in the ancient Near East was if you knew someone's name and you could wield their name, you would have a certain measure of control over that person. We'll deal with that on Wednesday nights We've already kind of breached that a little bit. We'll come to it more later on. But all that to say, it's an attempt at intimidation, perhaps, maybe even likely. An attempt at intimidation where the unclean spirit tries to intimidate Christ, perhaps run him out. But notice Jesus' response. Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent, come out of him." With a word, Jesus gives a command, and he obeys. I think that's the big difference between the teachings of Jesus and the command of Jesus. Throughout the Gospels, teaching all over the place, and it leaves open this ability, do I take the teaching, do I reject the teaching? When Jesus gives a command, follow me, what happens? They follow him. When Jesus gives a command, be still, the storm stops. When Jesus says, be quiet and come out of him, spirit comes out. That is an exertion of power we can't even imagine. Can you imagine what it would be like if someone possessed, walked in here, and started making noise, and someone walked up to him and said, be quiet and come out of him? You'd have more than a few hairs on the back of your neck standing up. The authority of Christ is absolutely overwhelming. Absolutely overwhelming. Nothing compares to it. This sort of thing right here is what surprises the disciples again and again and again and again. The things he's able to do with the word, absolutely amazing. And so we'll just end with this. Jesus has absolute power to command anything he desires or anyone he desires and turn it to his advantage. The irony here is the demon kind of lets a big thing slip, right? You're the Son of God. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Jesus can turn all, even bad things, into his advantage with a word. And he holds absolute authority to teach all wisdom. And that comes through human agents, like Paul, like other teachers throughout the New Testament era. So three things here, just three statements. I'll let it sit. Jesus' authority must win our hearts against other desires. What I mean by that is when Jesus' teaching runs up counter to what we want him to teach, do we say, I wish he wouldn't have said that? I wish he wouldn't hit me there. Jesus' teaching must win our hearts against all other desires. Second, Jesus' teaching must win our hearts against all other interests. If Jesus' authority is not seen to be the most amazing thing that you've ever seen, spend more time beholding the Lamb. If his authority doesn't overwhelm you, spend more time beholding the Lamb, because it will. One thing is assured, if you spend enough time looking at Christ, he will amaze you. And third, Jesus' authority will prevail. No temptation is going to overcome it. No earthly power is going to subdue it. No one can contain him. He's got it all. He commands everything with a word. And if we say, I don't know if his authority will prevail over this person, or I don't know if his authority will prevail over this temptation, that's where he says, don't be shaken to and fro. Don't be of little faith. My authority will prevail. And it always does. And it always will. Let's pray. Our Father, you have all authority in heaven and on earth, and you have given it to your Son. Your Son commands things that we can't even imagine being commanded. And he does it with a word. Would you help us be overwhelmed by the person of Jesus? Would you teach us to admire with awe his authority and his power? Would you help us say, along with the people who heard him over 2,000 years ago, with what authority does he teach? And with what authority does he change lives? We pray that he would meet us here today and every day hereafter with that authority to change our lives and to teach us in the way we should go. And would you not only impact our minds by that, but impact every sense we have? We ask it in his name.